It was actually on this day, April 30th, 1968, when hundreds of students at Columbia University started a revolt on campus. Students went on strike. They occupied five buildings, including the president's office and Low Library. The students barricaded themselves inside the buildings for days. They were protesting Columbia's ties to military research and plans to build a university gymnasium in a public park in Harlem. The protests began less than 3 weeks after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. The 1968 Columbia uprising inspired student protests across the country. This is an excerpt from the documentary Columbia Revolt by Third World Newsreel.
Students at Columbia moved to take over buildings despite warnings from campus officials.
In order to show the solidarity of people with six strike leaders who they tried to suspend, they decided to take Hamilton once again.
Then set up barricades inside the administration buildings.
First day in math, we set up a defense committee which took care of putting up the barricades. We decided what our policy would be toward police, toward jocks. We soaped some of the stairs. We taped the windows. We emptied bookcases and put them up in front of the windows in case tear gas canisters did get through the tape.
And it hung up a lot of people when there'd be a little scratch or a mar on one of the marble top desks or something. At the second time we built barricades, these hang-ups had disappeared, and we had decided that barricades were necessary politically and strategically, and anything went in making strong and, this time, permanent-type barricades.
The defense is all taken care of. Security is a problem. Letting people in and out of the buildings. Watches. We need people to watch the windows every night.
We had a walkie-talkie set up. Citizens banned walkie-talkies. Plus, there were telephone communications to every building, which the university tapped. We had three mimeographs that worked constantly, and there were people who did nothing during the strike but relate to the mimeograph machine. And there was a big sign on the wall, quote from somebody in Berkeley, which says, five students and a mimeograph machine can do more harm to a university than an army.
An excerpt from the documentary Columbia Revolt by Third World Newsreel about 1968. Juan Gonzalez, Democracy Now! Co-host, introduced that tape when we first aired it on Democracy Now! On the 40th anniversary of the Columbia 1968 strike. Juan Gonzalez was one of the founders of the Young Lords and one of the leaders of the Columbia Student Revolt in 1968. Yes, in 2008, on that 40th anniversary, we spoke with a number of the activists involved in the Columbia strike, including William Sales, who was a leader of the Student Afro-American Society at Columbia, and then the chair of African-American Studies at Seton Hall University in New Jersey, as well as Gus Reisbach, who was a leading figure in Students for a Democratic Society at Columbia in 1968, then became a New York State Supreme Court judge in Brooklyn. We began the conversation with Juan Gonzalez speaking on that 40th anniversary of the student strike and takeover of Hamilton Hall.
I want to go into the dorms with all of you, with some of you who may not agree with a lot of what we've been saying here, who have questions, who support us, who want to know more. Let's go to the dorms. Let's talk quietly in small groups. We'll be there, and everyone in Livingston Lobby, Inferno Lobby, and Carmen Lobby. We'll be there, and we'll talk about the issues involved, and we'll talk about where this country is going, and where this university is going, and what it's doing in this society, and what we would like it to do, and what we would, and how we would like to exchange with you our ideas over it. Come join us now.
That
That was Juan Gonzalez, courtesy of the Pacifica Radio Archives. Juan, you speaking 40 years ago, explain the context.
Well, in the process of trying to build the strike, we were going into all the various dorms of the students and holding what SDS used to hold a lot of in those days, which were discussion groups or political discussions, group discussions, and we were trying to win over more people to the strike at that period of time. And this was after, obviously, the major police occupation of the campus, which occurred on April 30th. And as throughout the rest of the semester, there was a strike that shut down the entire university for the rest of the year.
So Gus Reichbach, now a judge, then a leader of SDS, please set the scene for us. How did this happen? Where were you before the strike?
Well, I was one of the few law students who was involved in campus activity, anti-war activity, anti-gym activity. The actual event itself was a spontaneous one in terms of the actual occupation of the buildings. But the predicate for it was really years of organizing on the campus, really beginning in 1964. The year before, there had been a big demonstration about recruitment and ROTC. The gym was becoming an escalating issue. People were getting more and more responsive to the protests of the local community in Harlem who was opposing the gym. So, we're often given, I'm happy to say, more credit than we deserve in the sense that this was seen as a well-calculated plot, where at any point along that day, things might have taken a different turn. In fact, probably if Dean Coleman in Hamilton Hall had opened his door and received a petition, the occupation may never have occurred. So things proceed in peculiar ways, but even though the events were unplanned, the lead-up involved years of organizing.
You mentioned 64, Bill Sayles, 65, Malcolm X was gunned down not far from there. Now, actually, at the Audubon Ballroom, that's been taken over by a new building, the Columbia University Biotech Building, also very controversial. Did that play a role, though that was 3 years before?
The Students Afro-American Society has very definite links to Malcolm X through the son of Kenneth Clark, Hilton Clark, who was one of the founding members of that organization, was very much inspired by Malcolm X. SAAS always had a distinctly black nationalist aura about it. That was basically its guiding principle. So we saw ourselves as being in a tradition that had been highlighted by Malcolm X. When we actually took over Hamilton Hall, we renamed it Nat Turner Hall of Malcolm X University.
Explain who Nat Turner was.
Nat Turner was a slave preacher who in 1831 in Southampton County, Virginia, led the largest slave revolt on the North American mainland.
Bill, one of the things I think that most people are not aware of, because sometimes they don't connect all of the events that leading up to a particular crisis, was the climate. As I've often mentioned, this strike, or the occupation, began less than 3 weeks after the King assassination. And the impact on young people then, not only of the assassination, but of the disturbances and rebellions that broke out in over 100 cities across the country. I don't know if any of you want to talk about what the climate for young people was at that moment, at that particular moment in history.
Well, I certainly can speak to the African-American experience, and it's certainly what made it an important experience was that for the first time that other than African Americans were also being caught up in that energy. Most of the people in Hamilton Hall had been in one or another urban region. You mentioned the King assassination. That very night, I and Ray Brown and other people would go on to play leadership roles in a takeover. We were on 125th Street. First time anybody ever shot at me. It was a policeman shooting over my head on 125th Street as various stores went up in flames. We were also much earlier that previous summer in Newark, during the Newark rebellions. We had raised funds in support of the families of students killed on February the 8th, I think, at Orangeburg, South Carolina. So there was a continuous involvement in the turmoils of the day that incorporated larger and larger numbers of people who ultimately would take over those buildings.
That was William Sales, leader of the Student Afro-American Society at Columbia in 1968, then the chair of African-American Studies at Seton Hall University in New Jersey, and Gus Reisbach, who was a leader in Student for a Democratic Side at Columbia in 1968. He was a Columbia law student, then a New York State Supreme Court judge in Brooklyn. Tom Hayden was also there to see our full interview on the 40th anniversary of the Columbia Revolt, along with Juan Gonzalez. You can go to democracynow.org. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue to look at the crackdown student-led Gaza solidarity encampments across U.S. campuses, we look now at how the Biden administration and several members of Congress have echoed intensifying accusations that the peaceful student-led pro-Palestinian protests are anti-Semitic. We're joined now by Omer Bartov. He's professor of Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Brown University. His recent piece is headlined "Weaponizing Language, Misuses of Holocaust Memory, and the Never Again Syndrome." The professor recently visited the student Gaza solidarity encampment at the University of Pennsylvania, sharing on social media a photograph with the Israeli historian Raz Segal and a message that said, quote, "With Raz Segal at the UPenn encampment on April 26th, warm and open conversation about the perils of anti-Semitism and its current weaponization," unquote. Omer Bartov is also author of numerous books, including Genocide, the Holocaust, and Israel-Palestine, First-Person History in Times of Crisis. He's an Israeli-American scholar who's been described by the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum as one of the world's leading specialists on the subject of genocide. He's joining us now from his home in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Professor Bartov, welcome back to Democracy Now! If you can talk about what's happening on these college campuses, what your visit to the UPenn encampment was like, as your own university, Brown University, students have set up an encampment, and their chant is, "From Columbia to Brown, we will not let Gaza down." And talk about what authorities are charging are the charges of anti-Semitism, although so many of those involved in these encampments are Jewish, with groups like Jewish Voice for Peace.
Good morning, Amy. Thank you for having me again. My visit to UPenn, I was there with Raz Segal. We first actually gave a talk, both of us, about anti-Semitism and its current weaponization. And then we visited the encampment. It was a beautiful afternoon. There were very nice, good students there. We sat and chatted with them. We talked about anti-Semitism and about its current use. There was absolutely no sign of any violence, of any anti-Semitism at all. There were Jewish students there. There were Arab students there. There were all kinds of young people there, and the atmosphere was very good. The next day, I heard that the authorities of UPenn had decided to shut down the encampment. A couple of days earlier, I was passing by the green at Brown University, and again, there was an encampment there. Students were sitting there quietly, singing, playing the guitar. It was all very peaceful. And that same day, I heard from a faculty member who had visited that encampment that he had received an email from the dean of the faculty warning him that if he were to show up there again, measures would be taken. And now this issue is being debated at Brown. I believe today, this afternoon, there would be a meeting with the faculty, many of whom are, of course, like me, very upset by this kind of arbitrary action, which was taken without any consultation with faculty. So that's the kind of context. Obviously, anti-Semitism, as myself and many others have said, is a vile sentiment. It's an old sentiment. It has been used for bloodshed, for violence, and for genocide. And no one should condone it, and obviously none of us would ever condone it. But it has also become a tool to silence speech about Israel. And that too has quite a history. And the current Israeli government, or rather the numerous governments under Benjamin Netanyahu, have been pushing this agenda of arguing that any criticism of Israeli policies, not least of Israeli occupation policies, this precedes, of course, events in Gaza, is anti-Semitic. And I've been listening to some of the interviews with Jewish students who feel threatened, and often it appears to me, and of course we don't have good research on that at the moment, but it appears to me that many of them feel threatened because they see a Palestinian flag, because they hear people calling for intifada. Intifada means shaking off. There's a very similar word in Hebrew for it, leitna'el. It's what a dog does when it shakes off water. It's to shake off the occupation. And there are Jewish students often who are influenced by the Israeli friends who feel that that is threatening. But there's nothing threatening about opposing occupation and oppression. That is not anti-Semitism. You can agree with it or not. Even being anti-Zionist is not anti-Semitic. There are hundreds of thousands, if not more, of ultra-Orthodox Jews, including some who are in the Israeli government, who are anti-Zionist. But they're not anti-Semitic. They see themselves as the epitome of Jewishness and Jewish tradition. So there's politics and there's prejudice. And if we don't make a distinction between the two, then what we are actually doing is enforcing a kind of silence over the policies that have been conducted by the Israeli government for a long time and that ultimately culminated now in the utter destruction of Gaza.
We were showing images of the Brown protest where you're a professor, and some of the signs read, "Brown, divest now." Another said, "No others like Hashem." Of course, referring to the Brown University student Hashem Ortani, the Palestinian-American student who is visiting his grandmother in Burlington, Vermont, with his two best friends, also Palestinian-American, and they were shot by a white man from his porch. Hashem was the most wounded. He is paralyzed. And then you have at Columbia the students who were skunked, that kind of chemical that is used where it sent 8 Columbia students, they were pro-Palestinian activists protesting, to the hospital. And it turned out that at least one of the people who skunked them was a former IDF Israeli military soldier who was studying at Columbia University.
Look, first of all, about Hashem, I mean, this is just a terrible tragedy, he and his two friends. This sort of combines both the politics and the rhetoric of hate that you find these days in Israel, and of course American discourse, which have unfortunately converged, and that's just horribly tragic. This case of skunking, over the last few months there have been many demonstrations in Israel against this government's policy, and the government has taken to using water cannon, often in a really brutal manner, that is firing it directly at people's faces, which is legally not allowed, and using this kind of stinking water, skunk, in central streets in Tel Aviv and in Jerusalem, again, to shut down any debate in Israel. And it's very sad to see that being also imported to American streets. Let me say there's an interesting difference between what is happening in Israel regarding Gaza, what is happening in the United States. In Israel, heads of universities have come out just recently with a statement a warning about anti-Semitism on American campuses, which to my knowledge does not exist in any significant form. That is, as I said before, not anti-Semitism, but protests against Israeli policies. These same heads of universities in Israel have been collaborating in shutting down criticism in Israel itself. And there was a very tragic case with a Palestinian professor at the Hebrew University, Nadera Shalhoub Kevorkian, who was first sort of attacked by the university and later was arrested by the police and mistreated really badly, kept overnight in a jail, stripped, humiliated. This is a full professor in her 60s and a well-known scholar because she had expressed empathy with what was happening in Gaza. And the main difference is that not only did university leaders not come out in support of their own faculty member, but there are many students at the universities that are actually supporting these kinds of policies. And I think we should be proud that in American universities, students actually are demonstrating in favor of those who are being oppressed and now who are being killed. And they're doing it, first of all, because it's the right thing to do. They're doing it also because they are American citizens. It is American taxpayers' money that is paying for the arms that the United States is shipping in vast amounts to Israel so as to destroy Gaza. And they have every right, and in fact, they have a duty to protest against these kinds of policies.
Omer Bartov, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Professor of Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Brown University. He's an Israeli-American scholar described by the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum as one of the world's leading specialists on the subject of genocide. Next up, an Israeli airstrike on Gaza has killed the eldest daughter and baby grandson of the late Palestinian poet and academic Rafat Al-Arir, who himself was killed in an Israeli airstrike months ago. Back in 20 seconds. By Karim Bajili, featuring Litrio Gibran. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show with the tragic news that an Israeli airstrike in Gaza City Friday killed the oldest daughter and baby grandson of the prominent Palestinian poet and past Democracy Now! Guest Rafat Al-Arir, who himself was killed in an Israeli airstrike in December. Shema Rafat Al-Arir was killed Friday along with her husband and two-month-old son. She was a renowned illustrator in Gaza. She recently wrote a message on Facebook addressed to her late father that said, quote, "I have a beautiful news for you. I wish I could convey it to you while you are in front of me. I present to you your first grandchild. Do you know, my father, that you've become a grandfather? This is your grandson, Abdurrahman, whom I have long imagined you carrying, but I never imagined that I would lose you early, even before you see him," she wrote. The website Electronic Intifada reports Shema Rafat Al-Arir and her family were killed while sheltering in the building of Global Communities, an international relief charity. For more, we're joined in Washington, D.C. by Jihad Abu Salim, a scholar and policy analyst from Gaza, executive director of the Jerusalem Fund. He was a friend of Rafat Al-Arir and is the editor of Light in Gaza, writings born. Jihad, welcome back to Democracy Now! We only have a few minutes, but can you talk about this latest news, the death of Rafat Al-Arir's eldest daughter, Shema?
Thank you for having me. On April 26, Israel bombed the building where Shema Rafat Al-Arir, her husband, Muhammad Abdul Aziz Siam and their newborn baby, Abdul Rahman, were sheltering in the Rimal neighborhood at the heart of Gaza City. This, of course, was a tragic loss for Rifat's family and friends and those who love him, including, of course, his wife and children. Shaima was Rifat's eldest daughter. She was deeply beloved by her father. And it was a tragedy. And of course, this tragedy raises many critical questions as to why is the state of Israel and its military targeting the families and relatives of those it has already assassinated and murdered. And as I have previously discussed on your program, by targeting poets, academics, scholars, journalists, doctors, and institutional leaders, Israel aims to dismantle the societal structure of Gaza. Israel aims to make life unbearable and to make Gaza itself unlivable. But of course, you know, despite the bombing and the killing and the mass destruction and starvation, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians continue to live and persevere in the entire Gaza Strip, but specifically in Gaza City and the north. And Shaima, Rifat's daughter, was one of those who decided to stay in the north and endure and not leave and not give Israel the Nakba that it sought to accomplish by attacking and destroying Gaza. So again, Israel seeks to eradicate, to destroy the social environment that fosters resistance and defiance. This environment produced figures like Rifat, who you know, people like him championed their dignity and national cause, and of course, Israel's aggressive actions and crimes no bounds, extending even to children, mothers, fathers, and newborns.
I wanted to ask, in this minute we have left, you talk about scholasticide. Euromed Human Rights Monitor published a report last month titled Annihilation of Gaza Education, Israel Systematically Erasing the Entire Educational System. At least 95 academics, including dozens of professors like Rifat El-Arir, have been killed by Israel. Jihad, your final comment.
I mean, this shows the scale of destruction of Gaza's educational sector. As you mentioned, the Israeli military killed more than 95 university professors, hundreds of teachers, and thousands of students in what has been a devastating assault on Palestinian education. All major universities in Gaza, including the Islamic University, Al-Azhar, Al-Isra, have been destroyed. And as students globally continue to rise and voice their protests against the genocide in Gaza, we must remember and mourn the enormous losses suffered by the educational community. And I call on the student movement to continue to honor Rifat's memory and legacy and to pay tribute to the countless educators and students who have perished under Israel's bombs. This is the best way to honor our colleagues and those who have carried the message of education in Gaza and unfortunately have been murdered by Israel, and to continue carrying their message forward.
Jihad Abu Salim, again, our condolences on the death of your friend Rifat El-Arir, and now the death of his oldest daughter, Shaima Rifat El-Arir, her 2-month-old baby boy, and her husband, just killed in Israeli airstrike. Jihad Abu Salim is a scholar and policy analyst from Gaza. He's executive director of the Jerusalem Fund. That does it for our broadcast. To see the poem Rifat El-Arir wrote, If I Must Die, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
For 40 years, the Simon Fraser Public Interest Research Group, aka SFPIRG, has been helping students build communities at SFU. Campus organizations like Out on Campus and Embark developed out-of action groups at SFPIRG. Action groups are one of the ways that student activists can take action for change. Visit us at www.sfpirg.ca. That's www.sfpirg.ca. sfpirg.ca to learn more about starting your own action group today.